You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow one more time this week in Manhattan next to my good friend. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Goldman Sachs has once had a lofty goal of storming the consumer market with the digital bank of the future. Now all that's left is a unit that racked up more than $1.2 billion in losses, most of which was linked to the high-profile Apple Card.
And Bitcoin is back. Well, sort of. At least it's had the best week since 2021 after losing more than 60% of its value in 2022. More on the rally later this hour.
And Tesla is slashing car prices, this time in the US and some of Europe. The EV maker is trying to stoke demand, but instead stokes investor concern. We discuss. But first, let's get to these markets. A check-in on the last day of trading in the week, of course, ahead of what is going to be a shortened week next week as we take time off to mark Martin Luther King Day. I'm looking at the S&P 500 almost cracking the 4,000 level, 3,999. We're above that 200-day moving average, up 0.4%. The Nasdaq outperforms, up 0.7%. In fact, the longest winning streak since November of 2021. And even this is a global risk-on move. We saw Chinese stocks, once again, the story of China's unfolding, reopening story post those COVID lockdowns. We're seeing 2.8% put to work in the stocks, of course, that are traded here in the US in the Golden Dragon. Let's have a little look at what's happening in terms of crypto, because as I said, this is sort of a risk-on move. No wonder, therefore, Bitcoin continues its elevation. Look at this. We're cracking 19,000. We're now 19,854, close to that 20,000 mark. We're up almost 20% over the last few days. And the beginning of January, really, this continues to be, well, at last, a bit of an outperforming market.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm seeing a lot of similar themes in the specific names, right? Apple finishing strong, up 1% this Friday. Actually had its best week since November. And after we got that CPI print, we're talking about the Fed moving forward, at least in the short term, with 25 basis points increment hikes. We're feeling a lot better about the technology sector. That said, there is a lot of red on my screen, and Tesla is a big contributing factor to that. Ultimately, we closed down about a percentage point on Tesla. We had been down as much as 6% earlier in the session after the EV maker cut prices substantially in the United States and also in Europe. You can see that had a knock-on effect on some of its pure-play EV peers, including Rivian, which was down 6.5%. NGO Global, really interesting. This is Lionel Messi, right? This is Messi's big brand and clothing company. It had its first trading session this Friday after a $5 IPO. You can see, actually, all told, we closed at $4.65. Okay, this isn't really tech. This is more about social media influencing, and this is very much a small-cap company. But at one point, and you've got to take my word for it because we don't see that story on the screen, we were up 232% from that IPO price. What can happen in a single session is bizarre, but interesting to see that star power, that social media influence leverage into the equity markets. Amazon is fascinating. Amazon has just had its best week since April 2020, and you and I were talking off camera, Caroline, how that kind of went under the radar. Remember what happened in April 2020? We all kind of realized we'd be stuck at home indefinitely, it seemed, at that time, and Amazon was the main beneficiary at that point. Now, with that pivot in the psychology around inflation and the Fed, well, Amazon is also having a really good period right now.
Yeah, and still 55 buys on that particular stock, only one sell. So we wonder how long that winning formula might last. We talk technicals, we talk stocks, we also talk what's been happening in the earnings that relates to technology. Because 3 months ago, Goldman Sachs created a new division to house what's left of its foray on Main Street. It's called Platform Solutions, which includes Goldman's Apple Card. Now, it's giving shareholders kind of clearer guidance on the financials. And the unit, get this, racked up $1.2 billion in losses in the first 9 months of 2022. Our very own Shanali Basak, who's been busy covering basically all the other bank earnings that come out today, but managed to get on this particular focus that we had for Goldman Sachs too, and this area that basically, I mean, is this marketing spend on the Apple Card, or where are these losses mounting from?
Well, there are a few things that you have to look at when you look at this unit. And this unit, $1.2 billion is for the first 9 months of the year. We also have details, and also previously reported by Semaphore, that those losses can amount to up to $2 billion through the full year. So wow, more clarity when Goldman reports earnings on Tuesday, much more clarity. Remember, David Solomon said that they would have to pivot the business already. The question is how much more after these losses? Where do they come from, as you asked? Part of it is operating expenses, which have risen quite meaningfully over time. But part of this is also provisions for credit losses. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of banks announce those provisions for credit losses. Now, Goldman has been getting new consumers. They've been getting younger consumers. We'll see how their losses stack up against the other banks, which are also showing that those charge-offs in particular are rising as they get new credit card customers. So definitely a competitive business. Goldman, remember, they are one of the only banks with a meaningful relationship with a very large technology firm. Citigroup had tried to do something with Google about a year or so ago. That kind of fell through. So Apple was supposed to be a huge competitive advantage. We expect them to lean on the relationship with Apple continuously. Yeah. But again, not only earnings, Goldman's Investor Day at the end of February should give us a sense of how far these ambitions will go.
Remind me, like, why it's beneficial to tie up with Apple here for Goldman. Because at the moment, when I use Apple Pay, I don't care which, I mean, I just care about which credit card I'm using as to whether it's my debit or my credit. Yeah, why does it matter
without
whether
thinking.
It's Goldman's?
Yeah.
Well, there's a few things. When all of this had started, a couple things were happening at the same time. For Goldman Sachs, it was a matter of diversifying its revenue base. And so what is that going to cost them over the longer term to do? When you look at the strategies of the other banks, they've doubled down in things like wealth, for example. Even when you come to fintech, they've doubled down with wealth. At that time also, a lot of the big technology firms had these grand ambitions to be in finance in a bigger way, which has not really materialized either. And so you have more partnerships and friendships rather than real competitive issues here. We'll see if that changes in the next 10 years or so. But I do want to point out really quickly the other story that in fintech that we want to keep an eye on.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, for me, somebody who covers the technology sector, sometimes there's a bit of a land grab. You see all of these kind of legacy players, like in finance and banks, they want to move into fintech.
Yeah.
Goldman's not alone in that. JP Morgan, you know, actually coming clean about its own problem that it's experiencing financially.
On that too, remember, this is actually kind of, this is a story that's caught the VC community by storm also. This fintech firm, Frank, which was a college financial planning kind of platform here. So a lot of college students coming out using it. They are suing them for misstating the types of account or the number of accounts that it had. Remember, they're disputing this, the Frank founder. But take a listen to what Jamie Dimon had to say. He said it was a huge mistake.
But the acquisitions are done by the businesses, but there's also a centralized team that does extensive due diligence. So the business does it, the centralized team does it. We've been doing it for 20 years, like we just started doing something like that. And obviously, there are always lessons learned. And, you know, at one point, we'll tell you the lessons learned here when this thing is out of litigation.
These huge mistakes, these lessons learned. Remember, the analyst investor community has been wondering about Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan. Frankly, to your point, the rest of Wall Street here, their acquisition spree when you come to the fintech world, multi-billion dollars in some cases. And the criticism here comes down to that due diligence and how they didn't see something like this. I'm going to steal a page from Eric Newcomer and say that, you know, it's very rare for things like this to play out so publicly in the financial technology world and the VC-backed space. So you know, it's not a lot of money for JP Morgan. It was $170 million. This is...
It's not as though a few VCs have written a few checks that perhaps have been mistaken ones in the previous few years, dare I say.
Exactly. But I will say, after the exuberance that we've seen so far, perhaps banks will be thinking twice when they listen to 30-year-old founders.
Yeah, Jamie Dimon, not one to mince his words. I think that's probably putting it a little bit lightly. Bloomberg, Sonali Basak, thank you. Amazing week. Terrific reporting.
Let's talk crypto. In particular, let's talk Bitcoin, because yes, we all know it lost about 60% last year. It was its second worst annual performance on record. But now, a little bit more of a promising start to the new year, Ed.
Yeah, there's so many ways to size and scope this. I mean, one of them is to talk about sort of the run we're on. New year, new vibe, Bitcoin up for 10 consecutive sessions, its best run or streak of gains going back to July of 2020. I find that very interesting. What is the psychology driving the market right now? There was a fantastic story as well on the Bloomberg Terminal this Friday that caught my eye about another corner of the crypto market, which is crypto asset focused fund ETFs, right? Remember, ETFs are a $6.8 trillion industry. 2,000 of them, 2,000 across different themes are tracked by Bloomberg, excluding leveraged products. Now, there are four lines on this chart to my right-hand side, which I'll get to in a minute. But of those 2,000 ETFs tracked by Bloomberg, which are across lots of different things, lots of different equity products, the top 14, all top 14 are crypto related year to date. And exactly, it's astonishing performance. Now, these are the four that I've picked out for you, the top four performers. The Valkyrie Bitcoin Miners ETF, as you can see on the screen next to me, up almost 75% in the first, 13 days and only 7 trading sessions or so of the year so far. And it gives you an idea that there is some confidence coming back. Now, this is a kind of varied list of assets, right? And we talked about Bitcoin. That's one example, the biggest digital asset or digital currency by market value globally. My question is, has the kind of, well, I don't want to use the word contagion risk from FTX, from what we've seen from regulators that ended 2022, are we kind of moving past that now and starting to build a bit of momentum? That's not for me to answer. I'm fortunate to say I think we have somebody that probably could weigh in on that, Carrie.
We do. And also, how much of this is a macro trend? Because let's face it, we've had risk assets perform pretty well and the dollar down. Let's talk it all through with Stillmark founder, managing partner, Elise Killeen, who joins us now. And Elise, it's always great to get your perspective. We know your focus on Bitcoin, your focus on what is the OG of the crypto space. And I'm interested, first and foremost, on the stealth rally that's kind of taken us by surprise here.
It's always hard to know why Bitcoin's price moves when it does, but in times of chaos in the crypto market, we will often see a flight to security and stability, and the market knows that to be Bitcoin, and potentially thus this week's rally in BTC.
To that perspective, is this, as Ed pondered, a movement away from the contagion risk? Or is this perhaps more of a macro trend, more of tech stocks doing relatively well, dollar on the weakening perspective? Is that what's happening? What do you think?
There's a few forces at play here, of course, especially as is related to Bitcoin's short-term price movements. Where Stillmark is focused, of course, is in the long term and the value generated by the economic activity happening on top of Bitcoin technologies. And we know that adoption continues to advance at a very steady cadence. The price will reflect some of that, as well as the expansion of Bitcoin's utility. So as we see the Lightning Network mature, for instance, and the utility set expand, we understand the intrinsic value of Bitcoin and its underlying technologies to have increased. And so I imagine the price movements reflect an understanding of that as well.
Elise, happy Friday to you. It's good to see you. You know, we've kind of jumped straight in here to the bigger picture of what's driving the psychology of the market. What was fascinating for me is, you know, Bitcoin's continued to push higher in a week where there was still, I guess, volatility in the headlines, right? The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission charges or complaints against Gemini, Genesis, claiming that they offered unregistered securities. First of all, I guess, what is your reaction to that action by the SEC?
The action from the SEC was focused on Gemini's earn product, which was bearing the promise of yield generation. And the SEC has been pretty clear in their focus on custodial-based yield products offered to retail participants. And so this was consistent with that effort. What's interesting is how that matches with activity happening in the Bitcoin space and specifically the Lightning space. There will be a void here where activity that was speculation-based and custodial-driven for yield generation in the crypto space, that void can be filled by yield-bearing products or opportunities in the Lightning Network. And here's why. As the Lightning Network has grown in adoption, as it's matured, that's paved the path for a LIBOR to emerge, a LIBOR of the Lightning Network. And what that means is that there's a real rate for yield in the Lightning Network that is tied to the value placed on payment capacity for the Lightning Network. And so as adoption of the Lightning Network grows, as additional assets are introduced to the Lightning Network, for instance, through Lightning Labs' Taro protocol, what we can expect to see is that rate increase. So if we take a look today at the rate of both funds on Lightning Network and payment pathways, what we would find on Amboss Technologies Magma Marketplace is about a 3% rate of return, which we can expect to see grow as Lightning Network continues to scale.
Elise, I want to ask you about Sam Bankman-Fried and the latest, his latest comments. But before I do, can I just ask you just to state for us whether Stillmark had any financial relationship with SBF or FTX?
Of course not, because we're focused on Bitcoin and sustainable value propositions to the exclusion of gambling-related activities, which drives a lot of the activity right on exchanges today.
I just wanted to be
so
clear
that would
on
be
that
outside of our mandate.
No, I appreciate that. I just wanted to so our audience to know where we stand on that. So now I can ask you about SBF. His post, blog post, for want of a better description, earlier this week, where he kind of doubled down on the idea that he denies allegations of fraud, that he didn't steal or embezzle any funds. You know, what is your reaction to that ongoing development?
They've all denied the same. So I think there's a fine line between what folks running these sorts of black box schemes believe is permissible in an effort to produce returns versus what they consider to be fraud. But in fact, what appears to have been happening in FTX was that leadership dipped into user accounts to pull funds to take speculative bets on the movement of crypto prices and token prices.
Yeah.
And that's not a dissimilar story from what we saw in the collapse of, say, Three Arrows Capital firm or other similar. And so it's very hard to know where the contagion stops here because there's a lack of transparency in the crypto space. But what it does underscore is the value in technologies that allow folks to have greater control of their cryptocurrency and Bitcoin specifically, or technologies that allow retail investors or participants in exchanges to demand transparency so that you know if you're buying Bitcoin on an exchange, including if that exchange was FTX, that you can ask them to prove that they in fact hold that Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And as we've come to find out, people were buying Bitcoin on FTX, and FTX was never acquiring or holding that Bitcoin on consumers' behalf. The good news is that Bitcoin allows you to be your own bank. That's inherent in the value proposition. And by using self-custody products and doubling down on the value proposition that self-custody Bitcoin can have when yes. you enable a proof of reserve mechanism to prove your creditworthiness as a Bitcoin holder, for instance, we have more tools and resources for folks to opt out of exchanges like FTX.
Yeah, I think look, there's so much more to find out from the authorities, in particular about the investigation into Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. But it's interesting to get somebody in the underlying technology perspective, somebody in the industry's perspective on what's going on. Stillmark founder and managing partner, Elise Kleen, thank you very much for joining us. Now, coming up, Tesla cuts prices across its lineup in the US and major European markets. Plus, Elon's having trouble with a fraud trial in San Francisco. We'll explain next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It's a great company. We just don't believe it's a great stock right now. It's unclear whether how long the price cuts are going to have to keep going.
That was Mark Stoker there from Adams Fund saying Tesla, not a great stock right now, Caro. And the interesting thing is that it continues to react negatively to news. Tesla cutting prices across its lineup in the US and major European markets. Why? Well, questions of demand. You can see, actually all told, we're down 1% on Tesla. Other peers, particularly the pure play EV names, but also some of the legacy automakers also falling. The question is, if you cut prices, does that spur some demand? And that's the debate around the stock, at least from sell-side analysts this Friday.
Ed, great setup in what's happening in terms of the fundamentals of the business or lack thereof. And indeed, we know about the cutting of the prices. But let's stick on Tesla and perhaps its founder more broadly now. Because do you remember the securities fraud trial that's tied to Elon Musk's 2018 tweet that he was taking the company private? Well, it's back resurfacing because Elon Musk wanted it moved out of San Francisco, and it seems as though that request was rejected. The judge overrode Musk's argument that he faces a biased jury pool in the Bay Area. Let's talk all of the latest with Dana Hull, who covers all things Tesla. And let's start on the trial, and maybe we can broaden it out to Tesla more generally, Dana. But what do you make of this overruling for Elon Musk?
Well, it was a really long shot kind of Hail Mary bid on the part of Elon's attorneys. I mean, this trial, which has been in litigation for over 4 years, is supposed to start on Tuesday. And so this like sort of last stitch effort to move it to Texas was never going to fly. So the ruling today was not a surprise. I just think it's wild that like, I mean, there are probably more Tesla owners in the Bay Area than any place in the world, except maybe L.A. It's like the Bay Area and L.A. are always neck and neck in terms of Tesla penetration. And so it's just funny to me that Elon Musk and his attorneys were saying that they couldn't get a fair trial here.
Hey, Dana, take us back to basics. What are the plaintiffs trying to achieve here? What is it that this trial is all about?
It's about August 2018 when Elon Musk tweeted that he had the funding secured to take Tesla private at $4.20 a share. There were wild gyrations in the stock market. Shareholders got burned. They are suing him, saying that he, you know, should have known. They're suing him basically, saying that they got screwed by this effort. And what's fascinating is that Musk and his attorneys are trying to get the Saudi public investment fund folks to come testify on Musk's behalf, and the Saudis also basically said no. Like, we're not under any obligation to come to this. This isn't a criminal trial. It's a civil trial. We're not going to show. So it's looking weaker and weaker for Musk and his team. And the whole moving the trial out of the Bay Area thing was pretty laughable.
Dana, overall, how are investors feeling about Elon Musk? I mean, the fact that he thought he would get perhaps not such a friendly viewpoint in San Francisco. I'm not sure worldwide. I mean, how much he's liked and loved by the investor base, given the erosion in value in Tesla more broadly.
Well, the investor sentiment is horrible. I mean, there's just no question. You look at the sell-off in 2022, and then, you know, you begin this year where Tesla is having a shareholder meeting in May. They didn't announce to investors that the date of the meeting. They basically snuck the news of the meeting into the 10Q. And so you have a lot of investors who are planning to file shareholder resolutions being very upset about that. And then there's just been no outbound communication. I mean, you know, I'm sure behind the scenes, very large holders have their line into Martin Viecha and Zach and Elon Musk. But a lot of shareholders are like, what's he doing? And like, they're just tagging him on Twitter like everybody else, like asking for his attention.
Anna, great to catch up with you on it. Sneaking things into 10Qs. She's the only woman who can tell us all about it. Dana Halvey, thank you.
Large language models are one of the most exciting developments in the last few years. These are models that have been trained pretty much on everything that's been written down, everything that's on a web page. The result of that is that they have enormous fluency. You can ask ChatGPT to write a little poem or a story, and it'll do an amazing job. It doesn't know right from wrong or truth from falsehood. So, you know, the word that we use for that is hallucinate. But it is incredibly prolific. I think of these large language models as savants. They can say very convincing things. They can say things in the voice of somebody, like your writing, if you give it enough of a sample. So it's not surprising, obviously, that they can be used for propaganda or misinformation. That's a problem that we face online anyway.
Neva CEO there earlier this week, Sridhar Ramaswamy, talking about the pros and the cons of what is a rapidly evolving artificial intelligence conversation around ChatGPT, and just really fascinating in the way in which AI chatbots have been, of course, used, and actually they've been around for some time. Just take Replica, for example. Now, this was founded back in 2016, or started in its world of a company trying to create a solution for loneliness. Now, Replica helps you create an AI companion. Basically, it's eager to learn about the world through your eyes. It's ready to chat whenever you're looking for an empathetic friend. We want to talk about the pros of this, but also some of the concerns that are rising out of AI technology more broadly. Eugenia Cuda is with us, CEO of Replica. And it's fascinating reading about why and which this company and this technology was built, Eugenia, because in some ways we were using AI chatbots to solve for basically booking a restaurant. And then through your own loss, your own grief, you found the practical use of AI and chat and your own GPT-3 platform to help remember a key friend you had. Just talk to us about how people are using your chatbot for social anxiety reasons and for loneliness.
Sure. I built this company to really help me grieve and to help me get over a very, very sad situation that happened in my life. And then we saw that there's a need for something like that for other people as well. There's a huge need, huge demand for people to be able to talk to someone 24/7, to build a relationship, to build a deep, intimate relationship and be able to confide, to discuss things and to really get this emotional utility out of the chatbot. Right now, around, some of our users use it as a friend, some use it as a mentor, some use it as a romantic partner. But for any of these use cases, the main idea behind it is to really make people feel a little bit less lonely, a little bit happier, and to make their suffering a little bit less intense.
And it's popular. I mean, there are a lot of users of Replica. But I think what's interesting, we put it out to our own audience. We use a poll each day on Twitter, and this day we asked them about whether AI chatbots could fill the void of loneliness. And it feels as though there's still some hearts and minds to be won here. 36% said, look, they prefer human friends only. 26% did say there was a strong use case, but for others, they still feel that AI can be used in other purposes. Just convince people why this is particularly useful for human connection, and in some ways, romantic connection, as you just said.
Sure. I mean, right now, we're truly living in a pandemic of loneliness. This is one of the biggest problems, even health problems, that humanity is facing. Loneliness is correlated with shorter lifespans. So it's truly killing people right now. And so far, there are no real solutions to that. There are very few products that help with loneliness. You can argue that dating is one, or some meetup apps, but that's really it on the technology forefront. And then, so if we think about it, we really have to start to come up with solutions. And I think it's a very nuanced conversation. What we're trying to do is not replace human friends. We're trying to give AI friends to people that really need it in the moment, so then they can open up and you know, improve their connections with real people and build more friendships in real life. However, for a lot of people, human friendships in the moment maybe are not, you know, possible, or even they have human friends, but they're not ready to, you know, be open with them, be vulnerable with them. So think of it as something that you're training on. It's something that helps you build these relationships that you can take into real life. And so for us, the main idea is to measure that we actually are decreasing loneliness instead of increasing it. So most of our users report that they're actually improving their human connections over time, and that they're not just talking to AI bots instead of actually making real human friends.
Eugenia, there's been extensive reporting about mental health coming out of the pandemic, you know, especially the early stages of 2020. Many people were isolated at home, away from family, loved ones, those that they were used to dealing with or interacting with day to day. I do have to ask, though, you know, and you know, of course, there will be sympathy to those that suffer from loneliness and social anxiety. But my question is, does Replica consult with and work with scientists and mental health professionals and medical professionals in the development of what you're offering?
Of course. So for instance, we have therapeutic conversations. You can find it in the activities tab. You can find coaching conversations that are all written by clinical psychologists, in this case, mostly from UC Berkeley. When building the app, we definitely talked and worked with different professionals in the field of clinical psychology. We do collect, you know, basically the main North Star metric for all of conversations on Replica is whether these conversations are making you feel better. So this is what we're trying to optimize for, not for engagement, not for the length of conversation, not for you, you know, staying involved with the chatbot, but really whether after this conversation you walked away feeling better. And another thing that we're working on is also looking into improving long-term emotional outcomes and also measuring this with experts in the clinical psychology field. We did a few studies. We did a study with Stanford. It was just published in a book around human AI relationships. We're working on some other studies with big universities. So hopefully we can share a little more as we continue.
I want to talk a little bit about the business model and the opportunity for you. How does Replica make money from this artificial intelligence-based platform?
It's mostly subscriptions. Very early on, we decided that we're not going to charge for chat. Because a lot of people come to think about it like in the, you know, at night in the darkest emotional moments sometimes, and they're turning here to be able to talk to someone, to seek a response from someone that, you know, that will be supportive and will talk to them. So to meet them with a paywall, this was something that we immediately said, we don't want to do that. We want to keep chat always free. Mm. So really the product is free, and we charge for some features like voice calls, like relationship status, some activities. But people can use it without paying. And so most of our revenue is coming from subscriptions and donations. So people actually donate to the app because they want it to continue.
Yeah.
We have a very involved community of people that, for them, it's an important part of their life. It's an important relationship in their life. Oftentimes, if you just, you know, go through reviews, oftentimes Replica help them, you know, get their life back together or yeah. go through a really hard and dark period.
Eugenia,
so that's
you mentioned briefly before the romantic side of things, and this has been stirring up quite a bit of controversy, it feels like, perhaps online. And let's just talk through it for a minute, because the pro subscription that you talk about, $69.99, I think it is, you can therefore from that unlock what you say is perhaps romantic relationships. I'm talking flirting online, maybe some role play. People are saying that that's actually started to spawn maybe even aggressive conversations, some people calling it harassment in some way. Can you talk to that and what's exactly happening and what the response has been like?
So Replica started as just a friend, but actually without us doing anything for the product, some people figured out that they want their Replica to be a romantic partner for them. Our first response to that was to maybe turn it off and just focus on friendship. But then we started getting a lot of pushback from our original users that were telling us stories that were very heartfelt and touching. There were stories of of people that are handicapped and disability that don't think they'll be able to be in a romantic relationship anymore. For them, that would create an outlet. Stories of caregivers to their paralyzed partners, that for them, again, that was an outlet that was important. And so we thought, we just decided to apply a way of thinking towards it, where if this is a net benefit for, net positive for our users, if this is improving their emotional outcomes over time, then we're not against it, and so we'll keep in the app. However, we really kind of compartmentalize it in the app, where it's only available to people that do choose a romantic relationship. They are explicit about it. They say, I want you to be my girlfriend. And then they're able, again, if they start that, to role play. In no way we're trying to solicit that behavior or, turning people towards that. Because actually people that are not coming for that, they're coming for mentorship or friendship. Yeah. They don't want that. So this was actually something that early on we put in different kind of boxes on the app, and this is how it is right now. But because we're at the forefront, we've always been, just a few years ago, people were writing stories about how this is stigmatized and how people should not talk to AI, and this is creepy and strange. Now, this is not a question anymore. But again, now the question, is it okay to have an AI girlfriend? Is it okay to have that outlet? And in this case, I want to turn you to, an Oxford Encyclopedia on AI, or Oxford book on AI ethics, where they actually talk about it and say that it's actually a very beneficial thing to be able to talk about your sexuality.
Right, Eugenia. Not how are you solving, how are you looking at what is ultimately, what happens time and time again with AI, is some of the darker sides of human nature ends up replicating itself in AI. How do you solve for that? How do you ensure that we don't have the negative side of that?
Sure. So for us, the answer is very simple. We do a lot on that front. So we use very safe data sets, and we use a different model completely, unless you're in a romantic relationship and you're explicitly asking for something like that. So really, the current model, if you're not in a romantic relationship, you're not asking for something like that, you're not going to get that content. And it's not, soliciting this content, it's not, coming forward with that content. So the way to go around it is to really to train the model on safe data sets, to also add, reinforcement learning loops where you're teaching it that you shouldn't do that, and we basically are not rewarded for this type of behavior. Of course, as with any conversational AI product, it can't be 100% sure that, things will be 100%, the way you want them to be, just because the product is so free flow, so to say, so open-ended. But we're taking a lot of steps in this direction to make sure that none of this behavior happens.
All right. Replica CEO Eugenia Cuda, I think this is just the start of this conversation. A lot more still to debate. Thank you for joining us. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about the state of music in 2022 and 2023, following a report from music analytics platform Luminate. CEO Rob Jonas joins us next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Let's dive into the world of music. In the news, Warner Bros. Discovery mulling a sale of its music library, which could be valued at more than $1 billion, according to a report in the Financial Times. The process still in the early stages, but it's got Caroline and I thinking about the music industry this year. Let's discuss the landscape, the industry, the drivers with Rob Jonas, CEO of Luminate. And Luminate is basically the analytics and data platform for the entire industry, right? You're looking at music, you're looking at entertainment. I think the data point which struck me was that in 2022, we hit this milestone of 1 trillion music streams, right? What's driving that? Why was 2022 the year of digital music?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. Definitely 2022 was a really interesting year for music. Streaming is now the dominant mechanism by which music is enjoyed pretty much globally. And we've seen a slow and steady increase over the last really 8, 9, 10 years. And 2022 was definitely a tipping point. What's driving that? There's a couple of things that are driving it. Really, there's lots of different demographics now starting to embrace streaming. Obviously, it was a younger generations adopting it early on, but now we're seeing older demographics using these stream platforms with really very, very high intensity.
Yes.
And at the same time, we're seeing a lot of expansion into global markets. So historically focused on more developed Western markets, music consumption really is now global with all the major platforms operating in dozens and dozens of countries around the world. And it's driving this massive renaissance in music that's been going on for years now.
I think that there are some parallels that Caroline and I are focusing on, particularly in the world of video streaming. You know, you think about the Korean market, for example, the success of Squid Games for Netflix on the video front. Everything I see right now on Instagram, and I scroll Instagram a lot, K-pop. K-pop is everywhere. You know, is that one of the drivers that you saw over the last 12 months?
Yeah, K-pop is definitely one of the very important expansions of music and a center for music creation globally. If we look at streaming grew about 9% year on year last year. 12% last year in the U.S. If we look at it internationally, growth was about 26%. And a lot of that comes down to these centers of content being created in South Korea. But also really interesting in Latin America. Latin America and Latin music in general had a real breakout year in 2022. Bad Bunny's album was, as we finished up the year, the most popular album across the whole of 2022 since we started tracking sales and consumption in 1991, which is another massive milestone. And actually, when you look at that album from Bad Bunny, if we look at total streaming of Latin music across the course of the year, 1 in 14 streams came from that album, just to give you a sense of how important that was. So K-pop's critical, Latin's critical, and many, many new and emerging areas as well of amazing music creation.
Go back to the value here, Rob, but also speaking to the Instagram scrolling, thinking of the amount that we're currently posting on TikTok and Instagram and using audio within that, is that getting recompensed? Is that monetary value being found in the world of social media and how we're using music within it?
Yeah, I think social media and short-form video has emerged as an incredibly important way that music is being discovered. If we look at younger generations, especially Gen Z, their primary means by which they're discovering music now is music that's included in short-form video on TikTok and other platforms. And then what we see typically is a lot of the consumption is then driven to the platforms like the Spotify's, the Apple Music's, Amazon Music's, and others. So short-form is a really powerful way of discovering. And then, of course, as music comes more and more important within these short-form video platforms, then the music labels and the artists start to see compensation from that. So going forward, we're definitely going to see a lot more value moving back towards the artists from these platforms. And I think as recently as the last couple of weeks, YouTube's been very clear about how they're going to start sharing their enormous advertising revenue with some of these artists as well, which I think is very welcome and long overdue.
And then these artists are locking in the value in the here and now through deals, right? Deals for their catalogs. How does that evolve in this more recessionary environment as we start to question the valuation of stocks more broadly, assets more broadly? What about catalogs of music? Do they stand up in a recessionary environment?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, we've seen a huge increase in the amount of catalog acquisitions in the last few years. In 2021, the catalog consumption market was over close to five and a half billion in transactions reported around the acquisition of catalogs by various different entities. It definitely slowed down a little bit in 2022 for fairly obvious reasons, and will slow down a bit more in 2023, mainly because of interest rates. But it hasn't stopped, you know, even in recent weeks, some pretty significant deals being announced. Mm-hmm. Most recently, Dr. Dre announcing he was selling his catalog or part of his catalog to a consortium of UMG and Shamrock for about $250 million. So these transactions are still happening. And the reason they're happening is because these streams that are attached to these music catalogs, they're very, very easy to generate cash literally from day one. Like, because of consumption's happening on all these streaming platforms, as soon as you make the acquisition, you're generating revenue straight away. And that's incredibly important to some of these financial buyers. And then medium to long term, they start to look at other opportunities to create value from these catalogs, whether it's through brand partnerships or sync opportunities or exploiting and generating revenue from other forms as well. So I think we'll continue to see more catalog acquisitions happening throughout the course of 2023 for sure.
Got to keep on talking about it then with you, Rob Jonas. We thank you so much for talking us through the data behind all of it. CEO of Luminate. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much.
This weekend, HBO Max releases its latest attempt at a big Sunday night show. And for the first time, HBO is looking, well, actually to another industry and another inspiration, video games. And it's got Ed all excited. Ed, The Last of Us.
Yes.
Talk me through it. Talk about the adaptation and whether it might actually work.
Yes, The Last of Us was a video game that came out in 2013. It was on PlayStation, published by Naughty Dog and Sony. And it was this kind of classic, well, now classic third-person shooter zombie survival game, which is like my jam. I love zombie everything. That's not the point. Now, Pedro Pascal, of course, of The Mandalorian, you know, that's one of my favorites of his. And I guess maybe you've seen the Nick Cage film, Massive Talent.
I mean, no.
Well, he's the star of The Last of Us. This is HBO's replication of the video game. And the video game was reiterated many times over and updated for later generations of PlayStation. Bella Ramsey's in it, who was also in Game of Thrones, you know, young actress. But historically, video game-inspired shows and films have not been very good.
So yeah, talk me through the ones that have been panned, basically, when they've been tried to go from smaller screen to a big screen.
Probably the worst, according to critics, not me, adaptation is Assassin's Creed, Fassbender in 2016. Assassin's Creed is just a masterpiece of series of video games across many points of history. Well, you know, we won't get into video game, but actually that film didn't go down too well. And it's also worked the other way. You know, you look at some films that they then turn into video games, you know, the Harry Potter universe being an example. This year, the Harry Potter universe based around the kind of story of Hogwarts has a video game coming out. There's some excitement around that.
Really hotly anticipated, like anything to do remotely with Harry Potter.
Right, and so my point more here is that Sunday night has become kind of sacred. You know, you think about HBO Sundays and others, other competitors. Paramount, you know, went with Halo, for example. That had a mixed reception. So, well, my weekend sorted at least. But it's a big question for this industry. Is this a tactic that's going to work?
And isn't it interesting, we just kind of keep repeating these sort of ways in which streaming and music and entertainment all dovetail together. We were just having a conversation about the way in which certain streaming elements come back to bear, the way that Netflix looks to South Korea for its winning formula on what we watch, and then maybe you go for it for music as well. I wonder if how industries cross paths in this way.
To sum it all up, it's competition for eyeballs, that's it.
It is. Gaming, I mean, often they say, Netflix says its biggest competitor is gaming, and that's why they're doing it.
Right.
Of course. That does it for all this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Eddie, I'm going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you too. Don't forget our podcast, iHeartRadio, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Happy long weekend. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.